Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG. We're online at kpcg.fm, the weekend edition. Hey, there's a new president in the U.S. Did you hear anything about that? What should we expect? You might be surprised also to learn what some cows eat, especially if you eat cows. And the Southern Poverty Law Center asks our very own Grant Turgeon for money. Should he give them some? We'll discuss that and what they're up to, that and more. This edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on 101.3 KPCG. Online, kpcg.fm, live link at thetrumpet.com as well. You can follow us on Twitter, at kpcgfm. We tweeted out a picture of that albino deer, by the way, for those that know what I'm talking about. If you don't, never mind. And send us comments if you'd like to. Comments at kpcg.fm. I'm Dwight Falk, and Grant Turgeon is here today. And, of course, today is a big day and a big weekend. The new president coming in, President Donald Trump. Who thought they'd ever say that, right?
Everyone was laughing for a very long time, and then they all started crying.
Yeah, they had a story yesterday about some of the headlines from when he announced that he was running, and everyone just laughing. They just thought it was the biggest joke, and but he won. And now that guy from Shark Tank, you ever watch that show?
Mm-hmm.
I guess he's Canadian. I don't really know what his name is. I just know him as one of the guys on the Shark Tank.
Mm-hmm.
He's running for something in Canada. He thinks he can get in on this, too.
Is it Kevin O'Leary, that bald guy?
Yeah, it might be.
I think that might be his name.
I'm not sure. Yeah, but that's the guy. Yeah,
wow.
So I haven't read too much about it, but people have seen that you can get into office sometimes, mm-hmm. And I think people that are non-traditional, they're not, the traditional politician, are trying to ride this wave. So it's a populist movement. We'll see what happens with that. What can you expect to see happen with the president? Well, he thinks President Donald Trump has said executive actions are ready to go. So, yeah, that's the other side of the coin now, right? The previous administration, they love the executive order, and now the new administration likes an executive order. So he says he's going to do some of those. Before we talk about that, though, how do people feel in general about President Donald Trump? Well, the Rasmussen Report's daily presidential tracking poll for Friday for Inauguration Day shows that 56% of likely U.S. voters approve of President-elect Trump's job performance. He hasn't done a lot yet, but they approve. 44% disapprove. But if you were to believe the media, not a single soul approves of what's happening. But that's not what the report shows. 56% think, yeah, it's okay so far.
Well, yeah, the media is trying to convey that all of his appointees are racists and bigots and are going to hold black people up against the wall, literally and figuratively.
Right. The numbers break down like this. 85% of Republicans and 55% of unaffiliated voters approve of the job Trump is doing. 70% of Democrats disapprove. And, of course, most of the media are Democrats. So, if that's what you want to call them. I just call them radical left. But so, yeah, of course, that's a story you hear and you're going to hear everybody disapproves, but 56% think it's okay.
There's obviously a silent majority in the country, people who are too busy working hard at their jobs to complain about things all day. And that's why we're not hearing so many conservative voices.
The what they're expecting to see happen as President Donald Trump goes into office is that he is preparing to sign executive actions on his first day in the White House. So they say that he's going to take opening steps to crack down on immigration, build a wall on the U.S.-Mexican border, and roll back outgoing President Barack Obama's policies. Who knows, right? We'll see what happens. Trump, a Republican elected on November 8th to succeed Democrat Obama, arrived in Washington on a military plane with his family a day before and, of course, is sworn in on Friday. Aides said Trump would not wait to wield one of the most powerful tools of his office, not the tweet, the presidential pen, to sign several executive actions that can be implemented without the input of Congress. So everyone remembers President Obama's famous, I have a phone and I have a pen. Now the next guy does too.
I'm sure he's devastated that he actually started such a dangerous precedent, because now we're going to see it, the executive branch really utilized in the exact opposite direction to some pretty big extremes, probably.
Yeah. So that's always the way it goes. There's, you know, one side likes it and the other side doesn't, and then it flips around. The other side gets their crack at making their changes. So we'll see how it all goes, and see how the weekend unfolds as far as, well, you know, there's all these threats of protest, but so far, not nothing too crazy, the few incidents, but see what happens. Really strange story coming out of Australia. This is a headline. I don't quite get why they say this, but they say deliberate but not terror. Three dead, at least 20 injured after car plows into crowd in Melbourne. So similar to what we've seen in a few other countries, a car flies in, runs people over, kills three, injures at least 20. They're saying it's not terrorism. I don't know how they know that, but terrible event, any way you look at it.
Right. They have a pretty specific definition for terrorism. It has to be motivated by some sort of an extreme ideology, and maybe this wasn't. I don't really know too much about it.
Yeah, they don't give a lot of details yet. I think they're just very quick, it seems like, to come out and say not terrorism, to calm people down. Mm-hmm. But Australian authorities said on Friday that a man intentionally plowed his car into pedestrians in a mall in Melbourne during lunch hour, killing at least three and injuring at least 20, but said terrorism was not a factor. Don't give details on that yet. The 26-year-old driver of the maroon-colored car was described by witnesses as appearing Middle Eastern. So take that for what it is. One tourist said Melbourne's Herald Sun newspaper that Arabic music was blaring from the car. So that's what they're saying.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. Reuters reported that authorities had hit the vehicle, shooting the driver in the arm before pulling the man out of the car and making the arrest. Officials reportedly said that prior to the incident, the suspect was wanted for a stabbing that occurred earlier on Friday. So this guy's on a mission from something. Is he? Maybe he's just a, you know, personally very upset, or maybe it's a bigger thing. They say not terror, but we'll wait and see what the details are on this one. It seems a little suspicious.
It seems like a replica of a lot of issues we've had recently that definitely were terrorist attacks.
Yeah, and that's kind of the issue. Does it matter if it fits the exact definition of terror, if they're mimicking what they've seen? If you were involved in this situation and a car flies into you, that's terrifying. It's terror. Like I understand that there is a definition they try to fit things into, but sometimes that gets a little ridiculous too.
Yeah, I mean, obviously anyone who was there would be terrified, and anyone who was in the area after that might be thinking of the previous incident in the back of their minds, which does cause some fear.
Yeah, for sure. So we'll see what more details are about that as they come out, and of course we have news updates at the top of the hour here on KPCG 101.3. Here's an update to a story we had a few months back, the alleged bucket of gold thief in New York City. The guy that was caught on camera pulling out a bucket of gold flakes and walking down the street trying to lug this giant thing. They finally caught him. He was in Ecuador. I don't know if he had the gold flakes with him, but they did catch him in Ecuador. So we can all sleep easy tonight. Our gold flakes are safe.
Wow, they followed him all the way down to Ecuador.
They said he went to Florida, and then he went out to, I think, Los Angeles somewhere, and then flew to Ecuador. So they caught him. Caught him with the gold flakes. Well, I don't know if they caught him with them, but they caught the guy doing it. So, yeah, that was just a weird story when it happened, and anytime that pops back up, I feel like I must alert the audience to the outcome of the, you know, people were wondering, what happened to the gold flake guy? Well, now we know.
Well, hopefully that dissuades everyone from committing a crime when you can go down to Florida, over to California, and down to Ecuador again, and they'll still find you. They'll still catch you. We are being watched.
They should have just waited for him at the border. Just walk back up carrying the bucket. Hey, there's a bucket guy. Because he's coming back. Right?
We let him in, though, right?
Yeah, right, damn, they just come back in. It's kind of interesting with the presidential weekend, the inauguration, to look at some of the different details about presidents of the past, and this one might be of some interest to you. Here are some of the president's favorite foods over the years. I guess you get what you want when you're president. I don't think you have to wait and see what the menu is. I'm assuming you get to dictate the menu.
Hopefully.
There's a lot of little things like that that I don't know how they work, and I am kind of curious. Mm-hmm. Like what, you know, how much they have their own, you know, cooks and chefs and things. They probably get whatever they want.
Mac and cheese every night.
If that's what you want, go ahead and get it. I remember they used to always kind of tease President Clinton because he was always out eating hamburgers and, and burgers and stuff. I remember them making light of that a little bit. But different presidents like different types of food. Theodore Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt was a determined guy, they say, and when it came to dinner time, he made sure that his favorite comfort foods were a priority. He enjoyed pigs in blankets, turtle soup, what now? and fried chicken smothered in white gravy, and plenty of coffee, so we have that in common. So those were some of the foods that he liked. I've never heard of turtle soup.
I'm not too surprised. Seems like a country man.
Do you use like the shell for a bowl?
I don't know. That really does fire up the imagination.
Yeah, is it actual turtle or is it just like a creative name for something?
Probably actual turtle. I think people in the South would eat more things than we probably would.
That's probably true.
It's not like an insult, but
yeah, different places eat different things. Have you ever had pigs in a blanket?
No.
I think if I understand what it is, and I think I've had them, it's like little hot dogs, and you put them in a little dough sort of roll.
I've had cows in a blanket then.
Yeah.
So it'd just be beef.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, right. So I think that's what that is, but that's what he liked. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, he had no-frills eating habits, apparently. They say he liked a gooey grilled cheese sandwich or a plate of scrambled eggs. They say, best of all, he had the nerve to serve hot dogs to King George VI and Queen Elizabeth on a visit to the U.S. Well, that's like what we're famous for. That's our culinary delight over here. Mm-hmm. Hot dogs.
All of his choices just sound delicious.
He was a no-frills guy, like they said. Well, it was wartime. Got to be eating mac and cheese.
Grilled mac and cheese sandwich. Wow.
It's pretty interesting. I've never had that. But they do put macaroni and cheese on a lot of things. Red Robin has a mm-hmm. mac and cheese hamburger. My kids had that.
Right.
They like that quite a bit. It's funny, no matter what restaurant you go to, if they have a kids menu, it's always just mac and cheese.
And chicken fingers.
Yeah. It doesn't matter what they serve. It could be like a Thai restaurant. And it's still mac and cheese for the kids. It's always fun. I was like, well, isn't there some sort of like kid Thai dish that we could?
Probably wouldn't like it.
And it's expensive. It's not that much cheaper than the adult stuff. So we're pretty much to the point of just getting the adult meal and splitting it, mm-hmm. you know, because I don't know. I can go get mac and cheese at the store cheap. Like, I don't want to spend $5 on mac and cheese for the kids because I'm a terrible dad. John F. Kennedy, this is what he liked to eat. He was born in Brookline, Massachusetts, was a New Englander to the core, they say. So he liked to eat baked beans, corn muffins, fish on Fridays because he was a Catholic, and of course chunky New England clam chowder. So those were some of his things. I guess people like what they grew up eating. Mm-hmm. They kind of keep that with them.
Yeah, a lot of these places or a lot of these presidents came from some pretty distinct culinary locations.
I've never had, I don't think I've had corn muffins that I know of. Fish on Fridays, that's big in some places. Up in Wisconsin, that was big, the Friday fish fry. A lot of places had that.
That just sounds incredible too.
It is good. Yeah, they put it in like a breading, mm-hmm. you know, and it's just an excuse to drink beer. But in any event, Lyndon B. Johnson says this Texan president loved home state favorites like black-eyed peas and hosted a mean barbecue. I'm assuming they mean it was delicious and he didn't insult the people. He was the first to have a cookout at the White House. That's interesting. That'd be kind of fun out in the back.
That happened recently, actually. There was a cookout.
The beer summit?
Whatever it was.
No, that was that race thing.
Oh.
Yeah, cookouts could be kind of neat, I guess. But I suppose they have to have a lot of Secret Service around. They say for Lyndon B. Johnson, his weakness was Fresca. That drink, that soda. I think I've had that a time or two.
Understandable that could be a weakness.
They say he liked it so much that he even had a soda dispenser installed in the Oval Office.
I wonder if it's still there.
I don't know. Well, hopefully it's one of those where you don't have to put money into it.
Right. That'd be free.
Be fishing around looking for quarters. That'd be fun. You have, like, you know, I don't know, some other world leader over. Could I offer you a Fresca?
Or a hot dog.
A hot dog and Fresca? Yeah, that'd be great. Ronald Reagan, President Reagan. This Republican gentleman was known to chow down on mac and cheese and meatloaf at mealtime, but he's remembered more for his sweet tooth. He liked jelly beans, monkey bread, which comes back around.
Wow.
And chocolate cake were a few of his vices, and he could never get enough of his wife Nancy's fudge brownies. So that's pretty good if she was actually making them. That's pretty cool.
Fudge brownies.
Because I don't know. I mean, these
nice.
With all the people they have on hand to cook, if she was still making them, that was pretty interesting. So, yeah, he liked the sweet stuff. He would have loved that house that they're selling out in California, that huge mansion with the candy wall that we talked about yesterday.
He'd probably be let down, though, that it wasn't literal candy on the wall.
When we, if you ever go to a mall, sometimes they'll have a particular candy store. I think it's called Candyopolis or something.
Right.
I don't know if that must
right.
be a chain. There's a lot of candy in there. And every time I walk by, my kids' eyes get huge. And they're just, I know they want to go in there so badly. But as an adult, it actually makes me sick walking by that store. Just looking in there, I'm like, oh, I don't want any of that ever.
You know they built that chain just to target kids,
just
of course.
Just go after the kids.
Oh, yeah.
Although, I do have a kind of a funny eating story in relation to my daughter, who's five. We were eating a salad the other night. And it had goat cheese on it, like the little crumbly things. And she was eating it, and she just stops, and she says, I love goat cheese. I want to take all the goat cheese in the world, put it into one ball, and eat it. And I just looked at her, and I was like, wow. And I was actually thinking about it, like, that would be a huge ball of goat cheese.
It's a wise commentary.
Yeah. I think you'd be sick of goat cheese after that. Aren't you glad what we say doesn't come true? You wake right. up in the morning, and there's a giant ball of goat cheese out there. Well, go to it.
We're not responsible for your meals anymore. There it is.
There it is. You're going to have to eat the rest of your life. You could spend the rest of your life eating that ball of goat cheese. President Obama. It says, who knew that President Obama could cook? Certainly not me, but apparently he did. He has a family recipe for chili in his back pocket that he's been whipping up since college. It's in his back pocket, like, all the time? This seems like a little bit out there, but...
Wow.
He's maybe they mean... They just mean, like... He knows how to make it. Maybe that's an expression.
Hopefully he just has it memorized by now if he's been doing it since college.
Keep it in your back pocket. That must be just an expression. but I'm not familiar with it. Ben's chili bowl is his go-to in D.C., they say. He's also got a soft spot for snacks like nachos with guacamole, popcorn, and trail mix. Hopefully not all in one tub. That would be disgusting. So those are some of the favorites of different presidents over the years. That they like, and I suppose when you come into office, you've got to get your staff, and you've got to tell them, here's what I want to eat. But then they've got their physicians, too, who are probably telling them, like, you need to lay off the jelly beans.
All of those specific examples seem like kids' choices. Not in a bad way. I mean, I like mac and cheese myself, so.
Yeah, that would be very tempting to eat too much of something you probably shouldn't have. But so those are some of the things presidents have liked over the years. We'll find out what Mr. Trump enjoys, I guess, over these next 4 years or however long that goes on. This time of the year, all the tension in politics, the cold weather, sometimes you just want to get away. You want to go to the beach and relax. National Geographic has a list of the best beaches, according to them. 25 in all. We won't talk about all of them, but just hit a couple of them. And they're located all around the world, but we have a few here from the U.S. and a few other places. One of the beaches they say is nice is Sunset Beach in Brunswick Islands, North Carolina. I've been over that way. I don't think I've been to that beach. Have you ever been over to the Carolinas?
I've at least been to South Carolina a couple times, and I've gone through the Charlotte Airport in North Carolina.
They say at the west end of this remote beach, a mile from the access point, a solitary mailbox stands. Planted by local Frank Naismith in the 70s and continually replenished with notebooks inviting visitors to jot thoughts, dreams, wishes, and whatever else moves them.
Wow.
That could be really neat or it could be really horrible depending on what people do with it. So, and how would you know? I guess maybe somebody would have to tell you. Be like, what's that mailbox for?
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of unique.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Sit out there on the beach, contemplate life.
Read what other people did. Of course, you'd be flipping through it and reading, like, poems and dreams, and then all of a sudden there'd be, like, SOS messages. if no one comes, you'll find my bones. Like, what kind of a beach is this?
What's underneath the sand?
It's but that Sunset Beach is supposed to be pretty nice, I guess. Here's another one. Bowman's Beach in Florida. Shell hunters, if you like hunting shells at the beach, this is for you. Shell hunters hunch in a stance dubbed the Sanibel Stoop, because it's in the Sanibel Islands, in search of different types of shells, sand dollars, and other varieties. And they get a ride, they say, on the Gulf of Mexico currents. So you get a lot of different shells come up there. You can stock up on hats, buckets, and sunscreen at the general store at the beach, which is an island favorite. So if some people like to just lay on the beach, others like to investigate. If you like to investigate, this might be for you.
I actually might have been there. I caught a baby hammerhead shark. I believe I told you that before in the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah, and what did you? You said you threw it back.
Well, I think we just cut the line off so that it wouldn't be in the boat with us after we pulled it in.
How big was that thing?
Oh, probably 3 feet long, something like that.
That would be awesome / terrifying.
Right.
Yeah. Where's mom? Is mom coming? Yeah, you never know what you're going to get.
Because we were using these massive shrimp for our bait, so of course the hammerhead shark was attracted to that.
Yeah. Wow, you got to be careful. It's interesting. Not growing up near the ocean, really large animals, I'm just not expecting to see it. We were actually, my wife and I, we were on a beach in North Carolina walking. They had this a pier, I guess you walk out on it. We were walking out on that, and all of a sudden you see a couple of whales. You know, and that shouldn't be surprising to me, but it
was. Just there on the pier?
Yeah, they were just sitting there sunscreening, looking for shells. Now, you know, you see them out in the distance. They come up out of the water a little bit and go back in, and it just shocked me for some reason. I'm like, that's a whale. But I guess, yeah, that's what you expect. That's where they are. They're
usually animals do try to hide out, though. They're not always around when humans are there.
Yeah. They were out of ways, but you could see them on the horizon. It was pretty, pretty amazing. Here's another beach on the other coast, Cannon Beach, Oregon. They say it's 400 miles of public beaches up there, including this wide ribbon of hard-packed sand that has the added eye candy of Haystack Rock looming offshore. An annual dog show unfurls in front of the Surf Sand Resort. I would not want to be on the beach after the dog show for a variety of reasons. I have been to a few beaches in Oregon. Beautiful. Really nice. Different than, like L.A. beaches, because rockier, and definitely good for exploring.
So anywhere on the list is Arcadia Lakes Beach there.
Our local beach.
Our beach in Oklahoma.
Did not make the top 25.
Oh, come on.
Did not make the top 25. Although I will say that I have heard, and I don't know if this is, I don't have, a, I can't verify this other than hearsay, but that Hefner Lake, they say is one of the best places in the world to do windsurfing.
Mm.
Because it's always windy out there.
Right.
So that's something. But yeah, no, Arcadia didn't make it, sorry. For those that are not local listeners, we have a lot of listeners online at kpcg.fm. That's a man-made lake. And
and we are landlocked.
Yeah, we're landlocked. So it's questionable. Here's a beach. It's in Iceland. I'm not even going to try to say it. Well, maybe I will. Rhinus Fjärja. You know how Iceland, they always have like miscellaneous J's put in there. I don't know how to say it.
Sometimes they're silent, sometimes maybe they're not.
Yeah, so I don't know how to say that one, but it's a beach in Iceland. I'm fascinated by Iceland. I'm sure it's like any place. If you grew up there, you think, I can't wait to get out of Iceland. But it's an exotic location. I'd be curious to check it out. This beach, they say, on sunny days on the south coast, it's a pretty nice place. Ink black sand and basalt sea stacks are absolutely stunning. They say, but don't be lulled to complacency. Powerful waves are known to knock people off their feet. So if you like it, I send your kids out there, I'll go play in the waves. Things get blasted. Be memorable.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So it's one of those locations that's just very exotic. And I've always been kind of curious about it, going there and seeing it. Last one here, Sleeping Bear Point. This is an interesting one. It's in Michigan. So, you know, you don't always think, you think more of the ocean, but you've got the Great Lakes up there in the Michigan, Wisconsin area. They say pure fresh water and 450-foot bluffs means eye-opening swimming and vast views over Lake Michigan. You ever been to the Great Lakes?
I've been to Lake Erie near Buffalo.
It looks like an ocean. I mean, you can't tell. It's huge. And so you can go there in Michigan. And I've been to a few places in in Wisconsin near the Great Lakes and in Illinois. And I think I've been to Superior, Lake Superior, and Lake Michigan. And it is interesting because you don't think of it as like a seafaring area. But once you get up near the lakes, it kind of is. Mm-hmm. I've taken a ferry. You know, you wouldn't think of that. There's actually a pretty interesting little island up there just off of Wisconsin. It's called Washington Island. You can take a ferry to it, which I did. Unfortunately, it was very foggy that day, so we couldn't really see everything. But they have a beach there, and they said it was the biggest beach, or it had the most just white stones naturally. It was all white rock. And so they try to tell you, hey, don't steal the white rocks. But but yeah, it was totally white rocks. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what the local legend was. So imagine living on an island, and people say, oh, where do you live? I'm like, I live on an island. Oh, where is that at? Wisconsin. But it is. It's an island there. So it's kind of funny.
Well, yeah, these are some of the biggest lakes in the entire world. I mean, they're pretty much the size of like, the Red Sea or something like that. So
giant. Absolutely. Yeah. And so, of course, this next one's happening. This one's going to be an eye-opener for some people, including it was for me, for sure. It's kind of funny and then kind of weird at the end. And it happened in Wisconsin, too. Thousands of Skittles end up on an icy road, but that's not the surprising part, they say. This story starts out about Skittles, but ends up being about cows. Everything in Wisconsin ends up being about cows. A rural county in southeast Wisconsin had a sweet, sticky mystery. Along a highway earlier this week, hundreds of thousands of red Skittles were found spilled on a road in Dodge County.
Just red ones.
Yeah. Can you imagine that? You're driving, you're like, what's ahead on the road there? Oh, that's hundreds of thousands of Skittles, of course. They say there's no little S on them, but you can definitely smell the distinct Skittles smell.
Smell the rainbow.
They smelled the rainbow. They say no one knew where the candy came from or where it was going. Well, I don't think it was going anywhere. It was just sitting there. Where are you guys off to? But county road crews said the Skittles spill was actually helpful as the roads in the area have been icy and this gave plenty of traction. You know, sometimes they say you should put something in your car in case you need a little traction. Maybe just get a bag of Skittles. You stuck there, buddy? Let me dump these Skittles out. I'll get you out of there. And they stick in your intestines, too. They say so that's one thing that was kind of interesting. Here's the other thing, though. The sheriff's department later found out that the Skittles fell off of a truck that was hauling the red candies to be used as cattle feed.
Oh.
They feed it to the cows that you eat.
That shouldn't happen.
It doesn't seem like it should.
We're not edible from eating Skittles. Cows shouldn't be either.
Yeah. They say a former farmer told the CNN affiliate up there that candy makers and bakeries often sell rejects to be used as cattle feed because they provide cheap carbs. So it's the same for us, right? Going to the store. Could you tell me what the cheap carbs are? Oh, there it is. It's right over there at the checkout line. The practice goes back decades, they say, but it picked up steam in 2012 when corn prices were surging and cattle farmers were looking for a cheaper way to keep their cows and their livestock fed. They say it's a very good way for producers to reduce feed cost and provide less expensive food for consumers. So you think, hey, I'm going to eat pretty well today. I'm going to get myself a nice steak. You might be eating Skittles. I think that's disgusting.
Yeah, it's also pretty sad that we eat these things without much of a second thought, but then whenever the things we're eating eat them, it's really gross.
Yeah, so
maybe we shouldn't be eating them either.
My wife and I was telling my wife about this story, and she was laughing. She's like, "Well, are they organic Skittles though? Yeah, are they local? I'm gonna ask you one more time. Are those local? Yeah, it came from the candy company just down the road.
I was gonna ask the same thing."
It's a Portlandia reference, in case people are confused. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here at 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondo is stopping by. Did you know that cows eat Skittles and old candy and bakery stuff?
Yes.
You did know that?
Yeah.
Wow.
Why didn't you alert us?
I thought it was common knowledge.
I've known you for years, and this is the first I've heard of it.
I watched a documentary when I was younger. Because we live in Saskatchewan, that's like the center of the agriculture in the West, so farming, but also cattle, and same thing in Alberta, and they feed gummy worms and different things. Just, you see that cows in like this trough full of gummy worms, and it's like a kid's dream. Like, they're just shoving their face in there and
yeah,
eating them, and sometimes it sweetens the milk if they're a dairy cow. Because what a cow eats affects how the milk tastes. So they feed it sugar, or like with meat cows, they feed it for the calories.
When I was in grade school, our principal, he would always, every once in a while we got chocolate milk for lunch. That was kind of a rarity, but like they brought too much, so we had to have it. And that was a great day for us. So, and he'd come through. Oh, he was just a real big guy, and you could hear him walking, and the whole building would shake. And so he'd come in and he'd say something about, you know, well, the chocolate cow had milk today, or you know, something like that. So we knew it was chocolate milk day. I knew it was a joke. I'm thinking some other kids probably thought it was legitimate. Like, really? The chocolate cows? So that was a question about this story. You know, if they're strawberry-flavored Skittles, will you get strawberry-flavored milk?
It'd be rainbow milk, right? Taste the rainbow?
So. Yeah. There you go. So strange. I learned something. People such as Abraham already knew that. It was old news to them, but it was news to me. The Key of David program's coming up here in a bit on KPCG. There is a brand new program this week. It'll be airing here, and also it's online at thetrumpet.com and on television stations in the U.S. and Canada. It's The Prophesied Prince of Russia, Part 2. Russian President Vladimir Putin is a spy by trade. Of course, if you've read much about him, he's got a shady past, to say the least. United States President Donald Trump says that he will get along well with this man. Can Vladimir Putin be trusted? Could he be a dependable ally of America? It's a very interesting program. Make sure you check it out. It's brand new this weekend. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury from Edstone, England, talking a bit about the inauguration. Really interesting topic today. Of course, a few topics brought up, but Mike Pence is being sworn in on a particular passage, I believe out of Chronicles, same one that President Reagan used. And so there was an interesting write-up that Stephen Fleury talks about from PJ Media, where the religious writer says that the passage which relates to how to be successful, which is to humble yourself and to draw close to God, he said, yeah, but that has nothing to do with the U.S. And if it did, then we'd be in trouble because, you know, we're not doing that, so we'd be cursed. But never mind that, because it doesn't have anything to do with the U.S.
Oh,
but does it, though? That's the question.
I did see... it is interesting to see what presidents, sometimes they have an open Bible with the scripture. Sometimes it's closed. Depends on each one. But I did read a fact about with President Trump's inauguration today. He's having it done on two Bibles. One is one given to him by his mother. Another one was the Bible President Lincoln was inaugurated on. And then he also will have the most prayers of any president ever. He'll have 6 prayers in his inauguration.
Yeah, I saw that. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Did it give a list of all the different individuals?
Didn't say the names. They were 3 benedictions and 3 something else. I forget what the technical term is called. But and one of them is a very controversial religious leader.
Jeremiah, right?
No.
Oh.
But someone who's denounced Muslims.
Oh.
And stuff like that. So I forget exactly what his role is this, but it was a little controversial that he's going to be the one doing one of the prayers or something associated with the inauguration.
Yeah, very interesting to see different presidents and what they like to do and they like to people that like to come in and be part of those inaugurations. Abraham, you've got an article for us from The Atlantic talking about the inauguration. An inaugural celebration that rings hollow, it says. Commentators love to praise the peaceful handover of power, but this year it stands as a reminder of the system's fragility and shortcomings.
Yeah, this is a really interesting article. I think has some somewhat controversial statements and some things that I think are biased, but of course it's his opinion, which is fine. But it does bring up about an interesting point, and that's an American inauguration is very different than anyone else's. And that's because we do celebrate the peaceful transfer of power more than any other people. Most other democratic countries, it's taken for granted. There isn't a lot of pomp and circumstance. Commentators don't really talk about it. It's kind of a given. It's not a subject of conversation. But in America, it's something we always revisit every 4 years or 8 years. And so it's a it's an interesting part of American landscape, political landscape. And he does point out, though, that although we celebrate the peaceful transfer of power. America has some of those violent history when it comes to presidential inaugurations or soon after, more so than some other nations. And you give some examples here. 1860, when Abraham Lincoln was inaugurated, it triggered the secession of some southern states and later the Civil War. I mean, that's a little more complex, but it was his inauguration that began it. 1876, with the inauguration and presidential election, it almost started another Civil War. And then since 1900, two presidents have been murdered, assassinated. Six more: Teddy Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Gerald Ford, and Ronald Reagan were either wounded by a would-be assassin or escaped by inches. So
it is interesting when you go through that list, which is a pretty common list, but when you put them all together, you're like, yeah, that is a lot of trouble, actually, that has come up over the years.
Yeah, especially for such a young democracy. We're one of the youngest in the world of like major powers in terms of democracy. But yet there has been quite a few presidents who have been almost killed, and some of them are our greatest ones. Teddy Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Ronald Reagan. Ones that are very famous, ones that people applaud and almost worship in some ways. But they're the ones who were almost assassinated. So it is an interesting thing to think about, just how, although we applaud the transfer of power, there always has been an element in America of people who are willing to do extreme actions to change what they think is wrong. And it's an interesting point to bring up, especially in light of all the violent language and utter resistance from many people with Mr. Trump's inauguration and his presidency. Just the language saying that, oh, he'll never be our president. We need to get him. We have to make sure he doesn't finish his second or his first term. All these things. And they're implying peaceful uses of power, but it's not hard to think of how that rhetoric can spiral out of control or ignite people who are willing to do violent things just like they've done in the past.
Yeah, you know, it'd be really interesting is anybody that's really throwing out a lot of rhetoric. I mean, if somebody actually acted off of what they said, I wonder how they would feel about it. You know, there's like a headline today about Madonna, who she's not even relevant anymore, but she keeps trying to be. And she's got to be like 60 years old or something.
At least.
And she's just trying to act like she's 15. Anyway, she said, you know, we must resist low as we can go and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, there's a lot of people that just tweet stuff out or say things. But what if somebody actually did what you said? I mean, that would be a horrible, horrible thing. I hope that they are just kind of being ignorant about it and not realizing the actual, hey, somebody might take your word for it and do these things. Because like you say, there is a lot of people, and especially now with social media where everybody can say their two cents, a lot of inappropriate things being said.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, we've been talking about political correctness the last few days and lists of things you can't call people. Well, I think the left who are responsible for those things need to look at their own camp and see the things they're saying, because it can garner many worse results than they can imagine if they're not careful. And it is just one other interesting thing. A friend told me they were watching CNN and their coverage of the news before the inauguration. And CNN said, like, well, if Donald Trump and Mike Pence are assassinated because their cabinet isn't picked, then President Obama would be able to appoint who would be the next president from his cabinet.
Right.
And it's just the wrong thing to say at the wrong time. It's just an odd thing for one of the major media to say right before the inauguration.
Yeah, we mentioned that in passing yesterday because it was making some headlines. And yeah, I mean, you have to question, why would you bother saying that? I don't remember that being said about other presidents. So pretty inflammatory talk. And the mood is a little tense for some people. There's a headline here where when they announced Hillary Clinton at the inauguration, the Trump supporters chanted, "Lock her up." And they have a picture where can you imagine that? You standing there, they announce you, and people start chanting for your, like, downfall. You have to stand there and take it. That would be a bad day.
Yeah. I was watching when Jimmy Carter came in, the Clintons and then the Bushes, all the former presidents. And George Bush did get the most cheers out of them. I mean, it's not surprising it's a Republican inauguration, but I thought it was because usually the Clintons are pretty popular.
Well, you know, the thing about a lot of the media has talked a little bit about the dignity of President Obama, which is a stretch to say the least. I think actually President Bush had a lot of dignity because they attacked him in every which way, terrible attacks, and he didn't really respond to it. And that takes a lot of character to do that. So I thought he's handled himself pretty well in pretty tough circumstances. You know, and even when he came into office, obviously right away it was the 9/11 attack. But I've been reading a book where it talks about some of that history. And, you know, in the last few months of President Clinton's administration, he had a chance to go after bin Laden. And a lot of people wanted him to. And he decided not to do it. Instead, he focused on the Israeli-Palestinian peace attempts. They could have gone. They could have probably gotten him, and they didn't. And then the next president comes in, and then it's in your lap. So anyway, I just bring that up because, you know, it is interesting to see how one administration, what their decisions then affect the next administration, and it keeps going. But people always want to, like, look at who was in office and say, well, it was on your watch. Yeah, but it was because of what happened, you know, before. So a lot of different thoughts about some of the presidents, and they're talking about what President Obama's legacy will be, and I'm sure that'll change. The narrative on that will change over time as well.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting just to see how much of it exists in after the first 100 days. Because the Republicans could take pretty drastic action with a lot of fundamental parts of President Obama's policies. So that'll be interesting to see how much resistance it gets from the media and other places. But I think, as you mentioned, I think we're seeing the climax of this trend or this phenomenon where in Donald Trump's presidency, we're seeing the climax of American mistakes reach their full. And that's going back decades, generations of mistakes from presidents not standing up to certain nations like Iran all the way back to Ronald Reagan's time, not standing up to them like we should have, dealing with terrorism. Now, each president has had successes and failures, but I think the interesting thing about this is we're seeing the culmination of American failures from every president culminate in the presidency of Donald Trump. And he inherits an impossible situation. And it's not just Barack Obama's fault. He has a lot. He made a lot of mistakes. But I think you can see a lot of mistakes made from all the presidents, and we're seeing the repercussions catch up with us.
Yeah. So this article, if you want to read the rest of it, it's at The Atlantic, an inaugural celebration that rings hollow. Kind of interesting for this this particular weekend. And before we move into our next story, just a little one of our listeners sent this in because we were asking about turtle soup, what it is. Turtle soup is soup or stews made from the flesh of the turtle. The dish exists in some cultures and is viewed as a luxury or delicacy. The soft-shelled turtle was like a soft-shelled taco. The soft-shelled turtle was commonly used for turtle soup in Singapore and in the United States. I am learning things today.
I guessed right, though. It's actually made out of turtle.
Yeah.
Actually, I have an interesting fact. I walked with my in-laws. I watched a documentary on Boston and food they would eat in Victorian time.
Mm-hmm.
And because turtles are hard to get in America, that type of turtle for turtle soup, they would actually, I don't know who figured this out in the first place, but they would boil a cow's head and use the flesh from the head to imitate the turtle flesh. And so in America, in most places in Victorian times when it was popular, turtle soup was actually a boiled cow's head.
Oh, I'm envisioning something like they were trying to make turtle soup for somebody, like somebody important, and the cow's head inadvertently fell into the pot and it was too late. You had to serve it, and they're like, this is delicious. And I'm like, well, let's keep doing it.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know how many different kinds of meat they tried to imitate the texture and the taste, but cow's head is apparently the closest thing you can get to turtle.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Huh. Grant Scott, you got a really, this is just fascinating to me, because you got something in the mail. They looked at this list of people to mail things to, and they said, Grant Turgeon, he's the guy to mail this to. Why don't you just explain exactly what you got and what they're asking for?
Sure. I got a packet in the mail from the Southern Poverty Law Center. This is a radical left group that actually has their own hate map of about 900 different organizations. So any organization that they deem is has a Christian identity, in fact, they can put that on the hate list. Any group that is anti-LGBT, they can put that on the hate list. And then, of course, they think they know all of the racist skinheads out there and the white nationalists, the neo-Nazis, the neo-Confederates, the black separatists, or the Ku Klux Klan. So they think that they know every hate group.
So they sent this to you. They're warning you that there are all these hate groups all around, and they sent you a letter, and they're asking for money. What are they saying in their letter here?
Well, it starts out, it says, "Dear friend, if you're as upset as we are about the presidential election, I urge you to join us in the fight against the barrage of hate that Donald Trump's victory has unleashed." And then it's just talking about how they've documented about 900 acts of hatred in the 10 days after he was elected. For example, swastikas painted on churches, colored signs hung on school water fountains, mosques vandalized, Latinos intimidated with racist slurs. Remember, a lot of these things have been debunked after the fact.
That's right. And was he up in Seattle when they were protesting, flipping cars over?
No.
Or, you know, does he have a list of the acts from the other side that are even happening this weekend?
No, they don't have anything about the white disabled young guy that four black teens kidnapped and forced to say bad things about Mr. Trump and tortured him for 2 days. They don't have anything of what the left is doing. They're just talking about alleged incidents where there are no witnesses to back it up, things that people said, other people said. There are blatant acts of violence going on the left.
But, you know, it's amazing. If you got this letter, this packet, and you didn't know, you weren't really paying attention to headlines and what was happening, I mean, it could be very alarming. You could think, oh, wow, there's all these things going on. And so they're asking you to give money to their cause. And it strikes me because, and maybe this has happened in the past and I just don't recall it, but I can't recall getting something in the mail asking for money to, like, attack another group of people in the country. You know, I had somebody call me the other day and say, would you donate some money to the families of fallen police officers? Something like that, you know, where they're trying to help a group that it's a community service sort of thing. But this is actually asking for money to fight against another segment of the citizenship in this country. That seems strange to me. Mm-hmm. Hey, do you guys recall anything like that happening? Getting something like that?
No. The only thing I got some fan mail from the, or not fan mail, but stuff from the Calgary Flames when I lived in Calgary, when I'm a Detroit Red Wings fan.
There you go. Well, sports. Now that might be the exception. But this just is very aggressive against one segment of the population. And it's based upon a lot of assumption and also just some flat out lies. You've got more information about this guy. I never heard of the Southern Poverty Law Center, but Breitbart did a thing about him, and so or about the organization and the people behind it.
Right. This article is called Southern Poverty Law Center, Manufacturing Hate for Fun and Profit. I went back about a year and I just found this. I was looking into what the Southern Poverty Law Center is after I found this packet in my mailbox this morning. And they really are a fear-mongering group. We hear about fear-mongering in the media today, but this group actually does play up on the fears of people who are duped by packets like this, and they make a lot of money. Let's just say that. They make a lot of money. I believe they have about $175 million in the bank, worth over $300 million whenever you take into account their assets, separate from the bank itself. So they're just running this pretty much this money making scheme, and they're basically having to expand their hate watch list so that people are afraid and they will send money so that hopefully the Southern Poverty Law Center can destroy these different groups.
What do they do with the money? What's their aim?
Well, they pay themselves a lot.
Right. First, of course, yes.
And they spend $30 million a year on packets like this and different types of fundraising campaigns, all while producing less than other organizations that have a really, really tight budget. So they're not actually doing a whole lot. They're winning some pretty big court cases. There was one instance where they went up against this KKK group. That's actually admirable that they would fight against them. But all the assets that the KKK group had amounted to about $50,000. And yet they actually won $9 million from the case because they were raising so much money, sending out solicitations for, a donation.
Yeah, the real danger to this type of organization is that you can take a very extreme fringe like the KKK, which should not exist, but then they start lumping in all kinds of people into that,
mm-hmm.
and saying, well, they're all the same. And they've this Southern Poverty Law Center in their packet, they have sat there. They sit there like they're the judge and the jury about what people believe, what people think, what's right, what's wrong. And if they don't agree with what you think, and again, we're talking, some of this stuff is just if you identify as a Christian,
mm-hmm.
now you're part of a hate group all of a sudden. You know, that's an extreme jump from KKK to Christianity. That's a huge jump.
And there's other groups like the Center for Security Policy, which has outlined different tactics by these Muslim extremist groups to subvert America from within. That's apparently a hate group, even though it's talking about documented attempts for Muslims to infiltrate different.
So, yeah.
You know, it just, that's not really a hate group.
So the group that's actually pointing out the real hate group.
Right.
Is now the hate group.
Right.
Up is down, down is up. Right.
Yeah, it's insanity. But, you know, of course they want to protect the minorities and they want to protect all the different religions.
Except for white Christian individuals.
Of course.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's amazing. So how much are they asking for?
Well, they're asking for at least $25 from me, or
it's the least you could do, Grant.
Yeah, $15 from me, or up to 100 or more. And I'm sure a lot of people who hate Mr. Trump are happily donating to this cause.
The best thing that could happen for them monetarily is for the Republicans to get into office.
Mm-hmm.
Because then they can, if it went their way, it'd be hard to stir up the same sort of money donations.
Right. There are a lot of actually different quotes that kind of just show that this is a psychological attack that's commonly used on the left, where you try to paint all of your enemies as just these boogeymen or bogeymen, whatever you call that.
Either way.
Where they're just, such disgusting, repugnant people that you want to just attack them until they're turned radioactive and no one will even bother to associate with them anymore. For example, Vladimir Lenin wrote, "We must be ready to employ trickery, deceit, lawbreaking, withholding and concealing truth. We can and must write in a language which sows among the masses hate, revulsion, and scorn toward those who disagree with us." That's the tactic that they're using. And then also there's another quote here. "Liberating tolerance, then, would mean intolerance against movements from the right and toleration of movements from the left. Not equal, but more representation of the left would be equalization of the prevailing inequality."
Yeah, and that's, they're following that ideology to a T almost. And it's so interesting because most people know that that's, if they've looked into it, they know that's what they're doing. You know, there's the books, the famous books, Rules for Radicals and other things from communism. And they're following it to a T, and yet people are mystified. And some like, well, what is this? Well, it's the same stuff they've always been doing. It's just, like you say, demonizing anybody that would speak against their really communist ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of his former business partner, Morris Dees, is the man who's in charge of the Southern Poverty Law Center. And one of his former business partners said, "Morris and I, from the first day of our partnership, shared the overriding purpose of making a pile of money. We were not particular about how we did it. We just wanted to be independently rich. During the 8 years we worked together, we never wavered in that resolve."
Well, at least he's just honest on that point.
I don't know how many people have to expose this group before they go out of business. They even built this really expensive yet hideous headquarters building. People have compared it to the headquarters of Adolf Hitler or Joseph Stalin. It's like a high-rise trailer. It's one of the most ugly buildings you'll ever see. And they use the money that they're fundraising to build this thing.
At least build a nice building if you're going to be taking the money.
A high-rise trailer.
That's what it looks like.
That looks like it's prime for...
You need to look it up. It's called. They call it the. They mockingly call it the Poverty Palace.
Wow. Well, they need to. That sounds like it's prime for, area for a tornado come through. They always seem to hit the trailer parks. You got a high-rise trailer. You're tempting fate. Yeah, that's crazy. Well, at least, you know, hopefully people would look into this a little bit and see that the guy admits they just want to make a bunch of money off of fear-mongering.
Right. I'll just give you one more quote quickly. It's from the Fairfax Journal. It says, "It advises people to give your hard-earned dollars to a real charity, not a bunch of slick, parasitic hucksters who live high on the hog by raising money on behalf of needy people who never see a dime of it."
Yeah, that's just amazing that they would send that out. They got to really check their mailing list. They don't know you very well. You're not going to be keen to send them any money.
Not at all. Maybe I'll send them a reply, though.
Well, you should. You should be like, wow, this is really interesting to me. I think I could help better if you sent me money. I could further the cause in this local area. You know, the cause of being rich.
Of course.
Myself, personally. Wow, really interesting. Yeah, that's from the Southern Poverty Law Center. So whenever we can get something like that in the mail, we got to talk about it.
Yeah, it's relevant, I'd say.
Very relevant, especially for the times we're in. So pretty interesting. That's all the time we have today and this week here on Trumpet Radio Live. Have a great weekend. Enjoy yourself. And we'll talk to you again back here on Monday. For myself, Dwight Falk, Grand Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau, thanks for spending some time with us. 101.3 KPCG.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.